This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Coal ash. What a mess. Not just the coal ash itself, but everything surrounding the debate on what to do with it, all in the aftermath of the Duke Energy spill on the Dan River earlier this year. Then in June, North Carolina cited Duke Energy for 11 leaks at different plants. Later in that month, the North Carolina Department of Environmental and Natural Resources determined that Duke needed to repair or fill in pipes at all of its coal plants. Over the remainder of the summer, legislators and regulators made decisions on many aspects of coal ash pond remediation and regulation, and just last Friday, a coal ash management commission was sworn in. It wasted no time in deciding that the cost of cleaning up these coal ponds could be passed along to Duke Energy's customers. That raised some eyebrows, as have the numerous lawsuits surrounding all of this. It's almost as though everyone involved is suing everyone else involved. The governor and two of his predecessors are suing the legislature over the makeup of the Coal Ash Commission. Although Diener chose not to bring legal action against Duke Energy over new allegations of pollution at three plants where coal ash is stored in basins, including the Cape Fear Station in Chatham County, that decision did clear the way for environmentalists to sue in federal court to enforce clean water laws that they contend the state agency is failing to pursue aggressively. Indeed, environmental groups led by the Southern Environmental Law Center have five suits pending against Duke for allowing coal ash to pollute groundwater at various sites, and the Catawba Riverkeeper Foundation is party to lawsuits against Duke for its three sites around Charlotte area drinking water reservoirs. It's a mess. One we'll try to make sense of this hour in a conversation with three people and a news person who are intimately involved in all of this. Sean Heath is Vice President and Chief Sustainability Officer at Duke Energy. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. Rick Gaskins is Executive Director of the Catawba Riverkeeper Foundation. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having the discussion.
Both of them are in our studio, and Michael Jacobs joins us from a studio in Durham. He's Chairman of the North Carolina Coal Ash Management Commission. Thank you for being with us as well.
My pleasure.
And we're joined by Ben Bradford from WFAE News, who this is part of his job to follow this tangle, this wicked web of lawsuits and more.
Yes,
with
it
regard
is.
To Duke Energy. Thank you for being here. Let's begin with the commission, Michael Jacobs, because I'm a little puzzled about what happened. You folks were sworn in on Friday. As I understand it, the governor, Pat McCrory, chose three people as members of that commission. They were chosen, other members were chosen by other entities, but he chose three, among them you, and I believe he chose you to be the chairman of the commission. And yet, as soon as you were sworn in, he leveled a lawsuit against the legislature for, I guess, taking away his administrative power by doing what they did by appointing a commission or creating a commission. What's happening there?
Well, first of all, he didn't do it after we were sworn in. The lawsuit was filed the day before the commission met, and I was not briefed on that lawsuit, so I can't speak for the governor's office as to what they're accomplishing here. I understand his objective. I understand his concerns about the separation of powers, but we are trying to conduct business according to the legislation unless and until we hear otherwise. I'd also like to clarify just one thing you said in your opening comments. We made it clear in our statement at the commission meeting that the Utilities Commission is the one that decides how the cost of the cleanup is going to be paid for, not the Coal Ash Management Commission. So we weren't making any suggestions or providing any kind of input into how the cleanup is going to be paid for. In fact, the one point that I did make about the cost of the cleanup is that we need to be very sensitive to what the cost of it is because it will impact people in North Carolina, regardless of whether the ratepayers pay for it or the shareholders pay for it.
So you're echoing essentially what Governor McCrory told us on this program several months ago.
Well, I Duke has already committed with our strong encouragement that we should not pay for the coal ash recovery or cost of the Dan River. I think the big controversy or the big issue for the Utilities Commission to decide is what about the moving of existing coal ash at other sites? And as governor, I've got to respect the Utility Commission setup. It is their responsibility, and I think it's improper for us to bring politics into their quasi-judicial review.
So you're telling us that the Utilities Commission has made or will make the decision on how further cleanup is paid for?
Exactly. The Utilities Commission will decide how the cleanup is paid for. That is not part of our mandate at the Coal Ash Management Commission.
And you pointed out in a statement that you released to the press on November the 14th about how you perceive your job and the job of the commission, that regardless of how the Utilities Commission allocates the cost of the cleanup, all of our citizens in North Carolina who use electricity will be impacted through either higher power rates or shareholders paying for the cleanup costs. And shareholders of Duke Energy, you very clearly and very wisely point out, include the State University Endowment Funds, charitable organizations, churches, people saving for their children's education, for their retirement, and over 900,000 working and retired teachers and state employees in North Carolina, all of whom are owners of Duke Energy stock. But shouldn't Duke Energy shareholders bear the brunt of mistakes made by the company? When you invest in somebody, you're taking a risk. Isn't that part of the risk?
Once again, that is not the purview of my commission. That's the purview of the Utilities Commission. We are put in place to review and approve the classification of the impoundments and to review and approve the closure plans for the coal ash sites. So that's what we're going to be focused on, is we're going to be focused on making sure that that gets done right.
So, Ben, have you been following any conversations behind the scenes about what they're thinking at the Utilities Commission with regard to who should pay for all of this?
Not with the Utilities Commission specifically, but, I mean, this is a question that has been ongoing since Duke first announced that they were, you know, thinking of looking at how they were going to close these ash ponds. And we saw during the creation of the legislation that created the commission that Michael Jacobs chairs, mm-hmm. we saw questions about the who would pay for it and that going back and forth. First, there was a moratorium on passing along the cost to customers for a couple of years, and then that moratorium got removed and it got switched around. And ultimately, what lawmakers ended up doing was keeping it with the Utilities Commission, because the way that this model works is that Duke Energy is a regulated monopoly. So when they want to – the utilities are. So when they want to increase rates, they go to the Utilities Commission and there's a process for approving it. And I think that there's a philosophical question here, and it's – you know, should customers have to pay for the cost of these ponds that are leaking and have, you know, potentially toxic heavy metals in them? Should customers have to pay for that, or should shareholders have to pay for that? Or at the same time, this is the energy that that we use. These ponds are part of the process, and it's a similar setup across the country.
I would wager, Sean, that Duke Energy has an opinion on this.
Thank you. I was waiting to jump in. I appreciate it. So one distinction that I think is important to make here is we've said since February 2nd that the costs associated with the remediation of the Dan River spill will be borne by Duke Energy and our shareholders. And as you've alluded to, there are a number of agencies and commissions that have jurisdiction over the coal ash-related activity for Duke Energy. Over the course of the next year, the Department of Energy, Department of Environment and Natural Resources will identify designations for the 10 sites in North Carolina that were not directly addressed in the legislation. So you'll recall the legislation that passed over the summer identified 4 high-priority sites which require excavation. So that would be Riverbend, Asheville, Sutton, Dan River. And for the remaining 10 sites, there will be a very deliberate process to evaluate risk. And through that process, there'll be an opportunity to identify the appropriate closure methods. And as you had alluded to before, ultimately, the North Carolina Utilities Commission will have jurisdiction over cost recovery and rates.
Mm. Now, the Coal Ash Management Commission, Rick Gaskins, says that their goal here is to establish the most effective and most efficient management of coal ash in America. And they ask a question. Michael Jacobs asked a question in a statement that he released last Friday. He said that there are trade-offs that need to be considered carefully other than costs. Do we want coal ash cleaned up quickly, or do we want it cleaned up safely? You're with the Catawba Riverkeeper Foundation. Which option do you choose?
Well, I think it is always possible. There are a variety of options, certainly. But I don't think you have to give up safety to do it quickly. And there are ways of doing this, and Duke has announced plans, for example, for Riverbend, I think last week.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, there are decisions to be made about how you do it, but I don't think you have to give up safety. Now, if I could, I do want to comment on the cost issue. I agree with Mr. Jacobs that the focus of the commission's work is on those 10 sites that weren't given a high priority status in the legislation. But I do think it's important that the utility commission, or if it ends up being the legislature, when they decide who bears the costs, that the people who make the decisions about where the coal ash was disposed of, to put it in those ponds, bear some of the downside of making that decision. You know, I worked in private industry as an engineer, as a lawyer. You always presented options, and you had to present your superiors with options to say, what are the downsides if we do this?
Well, in favor in deference to Duke Energy, this has been going on for how long? 80 years?
90 years.
90 years.
Yeah.
So 90 years ago, did we have the environmental concerns that we have today? Did we know enough to have those environmental concerns? So when some of those decisions were made, were they making the best decision they could at the time with the knowledge available to them? Or do you think they cut costs?
I do think they cut costs. I think things radically changed in the late 70s and early 80s when they had to start collecting fly ash. When the Clean Air Act regulations started to kick in, you started collecting fly ash. Fly ash is the primary concern here. There was a decision point. I was working as an engineer on power plants at those times. We knew there was an issue with coal ash back when I started working. And decisions were made, and they were based on costs.
So let's go back, Sean. These coal-producing power plants have been doing it for 90 years. It used to go up the smokestack. It used
Correct.
To fly out of the smokestack.
Correct.
We called it fly ash. Then the environmental regulations came in, as Rick said, in the 70s and 80s, and suddenly we had to collect. We had to scrub what came out of the smokestacks, and that stuff had to go somewhere.
Correct.
So it was decided that we would put them in ponds.
Yes.
Water added to the fly ash so that it would not fly away, correct?
Correct. Yeah,
okay.
This has been an evolution over a 90-year period. And, you know, if you think about these ponds as engineered wastewater treatment facilities, this has been an industry norm for quite some time. So Duke Energy has 32 ponds in North Carolina. We have 66 ponds across our entire regulated footprint. And the industry itself has well over 600 ash ponds in the United States. So if you think about this evolution that Rick alluded to before, we've gone from a period of time where all of the fly ash was emitted into the atmosphere to a period where fly ash has been put into ash ponds. And then over the last 10 years, if you think about additional measures that have been taken for beneficial reuse and for dry ash handling on sites where we now handle a majority of the fly ash that's generated today in lined landfills. So we have seen an evolution of the industry. Duke Energy has been part of that evolution. So to go back in time and suggest that the actions that we took in the 1950s weren't prudent, I think is in hindsight, which...
What about the actions in the 70s that created these ponds? And we have 10 seconds.
Well, as I'd said before, the ponds serve a valuable purpose from a wastewater treatment perspective.
Okay, we have to take a break. We'll come back with more. So many questions to ask. We'll try to get many of them answered in this next 40 minutes here. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Paycor. Paycor is a cloud-based HR and payroll solution provider dedicated to helping Charlotte companies perform better and grow their business. Information is available online at paycorradio.com. And the Novant Health Thanksgiving Day Parade, Thursday, November 27th, Tryon Street, Uptown Charlotte, 9:30 a.m. step-off kicks off the holiday season. Details on front row tickets at Novant Health Thanksgiving Parade. com. Well, for writers, it is the best of times and the worst of times. The best of times because there are multiple ways to get your work to readers. The worst of times because readers have become fragmented and major publishing companies are, well, they're becoming more particular about who and what they publish. So the work of getting writing out to people falls upon the writer. It's a full-time job. We're going to hear from several Charlotte authors about the state of their industry, how it affects their writing, and more tomorrow.
On the next Diane Rehm Show. political showdown over a Senate vote on Keystone XL pipeline, ongoing controversy over its potential economic benefits and environmental costs.
Join that conversation on the Diane Reams Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks. Here on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, along with Sean Heath, Vice President and Chief Sustainability Officer with Duke Energy. Rick Gaskins is Executive Director of the Catawba Riverkeeper Foundation. Michael Jacobs is Chairman of the North Carolina Coal Ash Management Commission, which came into existence last Friday. And we're talking, obviously, about coal ash. The Catawba Riverkeeper organization has some serious qualms about coal ash itself and about how the cleanup is being handled and some of the legislative mandates that have been passed through the course of the summer. And we're also joined by Ben Bradford from WFAE News, who follows this as part of his day-to-day job. Talk to me, Ben, about the legislation that has been referred to several times in this conversation so far that went through this summer. What was that legislation?
Yeah, absolutely. So the big question after the Dan River spill was, what do you do with the other ash ponds that have that are around North Carolina, the 32 that Sean mentioned before the break? And so this was one of the big priorities for the legislature. And the bill that they ultimately passed, essentially, there are four plants you've heard them talk about a little bit that are kind of exempt from the rest of it. And those are, no matter what, need to be cleaned up. And that's River Bend, which sits over Mountain Island Lake, which, of course, is where Charlotte gets its drinking water. And then Asheville, Dan River, for obvious reasons, because the spill there. And then the Sutton plant. And so the bill says those need to be removed. The rest of them, there's this process to determine what extent is the environmental damage from the water, what kind of threat would a failure of a dam at one of these waste ponds, what kind of harm that could cause. And so then there's this process to determine one of three classifications. Is it high risk, which means that, you know, that basically the ash needs to be removed and put into lined landfills where even if water were to get in there, it would trap the water. Or is it, you know, medium risk, which has less protections, or is it low risk, where essentially they could keep the ash where it is, cover it up with what's called a cap, and drain the water out of it, so it would still remain on the banks. So when we talk about the Coal Ash Management Commission, we talk about cleanup. That's the process that we're talking about.
Okay, how safe do you think? How safe does Duke Energy believe these places to be? These coal ash pits.
We believe they're safe, and if you think about. So there's so much going on here, obviously, Mike, with the ash considerations. If you're a citizen of North Carolina, if you're a customer of Duke Energy, if you're a resident of Charlotte, what you care about groundwater, you care about surface water, you care about dam safety. Each of those are areas subject to regulatory scrutiny. Each of those are areas where Duke Energy does
regulatory
monitoring
by DENR or by the federal government.
By DENR and by the EPA.
Because DENR evidently fell down on the job on the Dan River. And there of these 30-some coal ash ponds that Duke Energy operates or has, how many of them were created and built by Duke Energy versus, was it Progress Energy that you bought? How many of them were created by Progress Energy?
I'm not sure the specific split of the ponds. So we have 14 sites in
North. Are you equally sure that the ones built by Progress Energy are as safe as the ones that you were responsible for building?
Yes, we've gone through.
Because I ask because the Dan River spill occurred because you discovered that
right.
A corrugated pipe ran under a metal corrugated pipe ran under the thing and it rotted
right.
away and it caused the spill into the Dan River. And it surprised you because that pipe is not standard construction for situations like that. How do you know that Progress didn't do similar things in all of their coal ash ponds?
So since February 2nd, we've done extensive testing and evaluation of all pipes at our facilities. So that would include stormwater pipes. It would include the risers and the spillways that are associated with the ash basins themselves. We've done additional inspections of dams. We've done additional groundwater quality monitoring. We've done additional surface water quality monitoring. So a tremendous amount of work has occurred since the February 2nd spill. And the coal ash legislation that was referred to before requires even additional analysis. So if a customer has concerns about groundwater, about surface water, about dam stability, all of those things are being evaluated very closely.
The Catawba Riverkeeper Foundation alleges that Duke has known for years, at least since 2008, that all 14 of the sites that we've been talking about on and off here have been leaking for years. Unless you dispute that, why wasn't something done?
Right. Well, and I'd have to defer to Rick for the direct reference to the types of constituents he's referring to. But if you look at the most recent plans that we filed with Diener, we reference all of the groundwater sampling that's been done for the past few years at each of our facilities. And in a very clear and transparent way, we identify which constituents have exceeded the water quality limits.
But would you admit that they have been leaking in some fashion for years?
Well, we very clearly identified which constituents have exceeded limits.
Yeah, they're designed to leak. I mean, it's not even, you know, leak makes it sound like there's water coming out that's not supposed to come out. But these are earthen ponds. And so what that means is—
But aren't they lined?
And they are not lined. Right. The ones we're talking about are not lined.
Okay.
And so this design is actually— when you have an earthen pond, that some of the water is going to seep out.
You're referring to the seeps,
right?
But it is not inconsequential, and the documentation submitted, for example, with the Riverbend NPDES permit shows that basically 5 million gallons are going through the treatment system, but 1 million gallons isn't. It's disappearing in those ponds. It's either mainly leaking into the ground and getting either into the groundwater or into our drinking water reservoir. And that was known. It was submitted as one of the documents as part of the permit application process. So they've clearly known about this. Mm-hmm. They've known about the groundwater violations. And by the way, every single one of these sites has a problem.
When you say violations, is that a term that regulators have used, or is that a term that you are using?
Well, if you look at some of the internal documents submitted by the regulators, yes. They have characterized these things as they like to use is exceedances. They have exceeded state standards.
Why didn't they step in and make—
Well, it's a good question, and I don't— you know, I can't look into their heads and know
Sean?
The answer, but—
Yes.
Why
didn't they?
Well, Rick, please finish.
Go ahead.
Finish.
Okay, let me just say that anybody else in the state that contaminates groundwater— uh-huh. The first thing you have to do is you have to eliminate the source of the contamination immediately. If somebody has any source of groundwater contamination, a leaking tank, a spill, anything, you got to eliminate the source immediately. For some reason, that standard hasn't been applied to Duke. And it's kind of mind-boggling because these things are sitting on drinking water reservoirs. They are contaminating a groundwater aquifer that people drink out of.
Did Diener come to you or the EPA come to you and say, we are aware of these leaks, what are you going to do about it, or here's what you have to do about it?
So, you know, it's easy to oversimplify these things. So okay. Keep in mind that, you know, there are many constituents in coal ash. And if you look at the exceedances that we've experienced in recent years, by and large, these have been naturally occurring elements such as iron and manganese, mm-hmm. which pose no threat to human health. An exceedance in and of itself does not inherently represent a risk to groundwater or to surface water. Each one needs – and this is how regulators would consider risk. What's the type of constituent? Where is the constituent? What's the magnitude? Where is it in relation to groundwater?
Is the real risk what gets into the drinking water either through seepage, as you've been calling it, or through a break in the dam? As what happened essentially on the Dan River. Is that where the real risk is involved, a breakage,
right,
a massive leak?
Well, sure, and that's a significant consideration.
So that begs the question, why are these coal ash pits located near drinking reservoirs?
Right.
Why? Why
well,
would they ever be put there, ever?
Because they're next to the power plants. And
so?
So
you have trucks?
Right. That's true. We do. So, you know, let's think about how do we solve this issue? Mm-hmm. So if there's one thing that we can agree about around this table and on the phone is, how do we solve this issue? The way we solve this issue is by closing these ponds. permanently.
Okay.
We are on track. We are making progress. Last week we announced, as has been alluded to before, phase one excavation for these four high priority sites identified by the General Assembly. That will account for roughly 5 million tons of ash. This is a complex issue. This is a marathon, not a sprint.
It will take years.
It will take years
to do this.
How many
years? 30?
Well, it'll take by 2029 at the latest, in accordance with the legislation.
Okay. Michael Jacobs is the chair of the Coal Ash Management Commission. Are these the kinds of things that you will be overseeing over the course of your tenure as chairman?
Definitely. In fact, what I've been spending my time doing the last 7 weeks since I was asked to take on this role is to try to find the best possible staff members who can help look at these issues. The legislation was designed for there to be five salaried positions, and I don't think that that's going to be practical to get the best advice. For example, in the engineering area, we need a dam expert and we need a groundwater expert. As you identified, those are the two biggest risks. So I'm going to try to bring on both of those in a contract basis as opposed to hiring one person who only has a limited knowledge of what's going on.
Yeah, I should point out. I should point out that you folks were sworn in on Friday. You have nine commissioners with no staff and no executive director at the moment. And that's what you're working on, staffing up, right?
You got it. It's it's like starting a new business with no business plan.
Great.
So I have. This legislation created a commission out of scratch. I mean, there is no precedent. There's not a team that was in place that I come in to manage. I have to find office space. I have to find computers. But most importantly, what I wanted to do was to empower and get the commissioners to be fully engaged.
Can I just comment briefly on that?
That, yes. You know, I sympathize with Mr. Jacobs, but we have a whole state agency that was supposed to be doing this for years.
I
understand that. And to say, gee, we're in this gigantic rush now. The permit that was issued again for Riverbend back in 2000 said, before you close this plant, 1 year ahead of time, you've got to submit a plan and Diener's got to review it. The fact that we're in a time constraint now is a time constraint of Duke's and the state's making, mm-hmm. that they didn't do the stuff when they should have done it.
Well, let me ask you this. Do you think that the reason Diener didn't act or didn't do their job as you see it, not maybe they did do their jobs, but you say they didn't. So from your point of view, did they not do their jobs because of politics?
I think they were afraid. There were a lot of cuts being made at Diener at that time by the General Assembly, and there was a sense among Diener staff that they were concerned that if they fought what was perceived as a very powerful entity politically, Duke mm-hmm. Energy, that they might get cut.
So, Michael Jacobs, you were appointed by Governor McCrory. Two other members of the commission, of the nine-member commission, were appointed by Governor McCrory. From where did the other appointees come? Who made those appointments?
Well, three of the appointees were from the Senate and three were from the House.
And you have said that the commission will focus on science, safety, and economics, not politics. How do you get above politics if everybody on the board was appointed by a politician?
You know, that's an interesting question. That's actually a very valid question. And I can tell you from my own personal experience, I wasn't looking for this position. And I can also tell you that I met individually with each of the people that have been appointed to the commission. And I asked them how they got appointed to the commission. And in most cases, they looked at me and they said they're not real sure why they got called. But when they received the call, they were told no agendas, just do the right thing. And that's exactly the mandate that I've got. And we are going to do the best that we can to focus exclusively, as you said, on science and economics and safety and not pay attention to the political part of this.
Do you understand why you were asked to be not only on the commission but to be the chairman of the commission?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I get asked that question a lot. And then the second question is, why would you take it? But I presume that I was asked because of the background that I have in academics. I teach two courses at UNC's MBA school. One is on governance. Mm-hmm. In fact, I'm the only person in the state of North Carolina who teaches a governance course. And I also teach a course called Business and Government. And that's the only course taught jointly between the MBA program and the law school at UNC. And so I have a framework for how to deal with these sort of issues. I understand the governance mission here, which is what my main mission is as the chairman, is to make sure that the processes run with integrity, to make sure that all the stakeholders' interests are considered, and at the end of the day, to make sure that we stay focused on the ultimate stakeholder, which is the citizens of North Carolina. So I presume that it's that background that led the governor to appoint me to this.
So position. In your mind, the stakeholders are the citizens, the ratepayers, the shareholders, Duke Energy itself. How would you describe the stakeholders?
Yeah, all those are stakeholders, and I also consider people like Rick to be stakeholders. I consider the environmental organizations to be stakeholders. I consider the legislature to be stakeholders and the governor's office to be stakeholders. And we're going to listen to everybody, but at the end of the day, we're going to try to focus, as you mentioned, on coming up with solutions that are the best overall solution. This is a four-dimensional problem, and a lot of people talk about one-dimensional solutions. One-dimensional solutions don't help. We have too many variables to consider, so we need to think about all the variables.
You have said that the commission will operate under three guiding principles: accountability, transparency, and stewardship. Everybody's on board with that on the commission? Everybody is on board with that in the legislature and the governor's office?
I can't speak to the legislature and the governor's office, but everybody on the commission's on board with
that. Can they fire you? They appointed you. Can they get rid of you?
The governor can get rid of me.
Okay. So do you think in the past that these three guiding principles, accountability, transparency, and stewardship, have been followed by the legislature, the governor's office, by Diener, by Duke Energy, by the people involved in all of this?
Do you really expect me to answer that? I've told you I was not going to comment on what happened on this topic before I was appointed to this position. As I said,
then do you think it will be difficult for you to stick to these principles?
Absolutely not.
Okay.
If you abide by these principles, you're going to come out with an outcome that maybe nobody's going to think is perfect, but hopefully most people will think is the best that we could do.
So,
and that's really what we want to do.
So will you be the guiding force? Will the commission be the guiding force going forward, or will Diener still have the final word, or the EPA? I guess the EPA will always have the final word, but who runs the show in terms of guiding this process of cleanup and remediation?
Well, our role is more one of review and approval. So we're not leading the charge. We're reviewing and approving what is proposed.
But how
so
do you interface
Duke
with Diener?
Well, as soon as I get some staff on board, we'll start talking to Diener about exactly how we're going to interface with Diener. But I can tell you so far that my interactions with Diener have been very cordial. They've been more than helpful.
I guess the question is, who does Duke listen to, you or Diener?
Well, of course, we listen to both. I mean, we're subject to the regulatory jurisdiction.
Well, I'm just trying
both.
To get to the bottom line here. Who has the power? And we'll have to get that question after we come back from the break. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Taylor Richards & Conger, a Charlotte specialty retailer featuring off-the-peg and made-to-measure clothing for professional men, artisan-crafted jackets with working sleeve buttons and high-threat count shirtings. In-store or at home or office, trcstyle.com. And Dixon Hughes Goodman LLP, a CPA and advisory firm headquartered in Charlotte, over 1,700 professionals in 30 offices serving clients in the U.S. and around the world. Details at dhgllp.com. Well, yesterday the Senate turned down, or the voted down, the XL pipeline, the Keystone XL pipeline. So on the Diane Rehm Show today, in 20 minutes, a look at the ongoing controversy around its potential economic benefits or pitfalls and the environmental costs. All of that and more on the Diane Rehm Show in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. We'll come back and talk more about our energy situation with Duke Energy and others in just a moment.
I'm Silvia Poldroli. In Italy, we treat our cars like family. They stand by us and give us years of loyal service, no matter how many Roman relics we sideswipe. So when it's time to say ciao bella to your old car, donate it to us. You'll get a tax break and we'll tow it away free. Turn your car into the programs you love.
Donate your car through the CarTalk Vehicle Donation Program. Call 1-866-789-8627.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about coal ash with Michael Jacobs, who's the chairman of the North Carolina Coal Ash Management Commission. Rick Gaskins, who's executive director of the Catawba Riverkeeper Foundation. They have some horses in the race here because they have some lawsuits pending about these coal ash ponds and some environmental concerns about all of the coal ash ponds. Sean Heath is vice president and chief sustainability officer for Duke Energy, and Ben Bradford's with WFAE News. He's been following this all along since Groundhog Day last year, February 2nd, when the spill occurred in the Dan River. I asked a question just prior to the break, given the fact that we have the Department of Environmental and Natural Resources, Diener, and we have the new Coal Ash Management Commission, which came into existence on Friday. Who has the power? Who do you listen to at Duke Energy? And then you said you'll listen to both, but who has the power? Who has the final word? Do you understand? Do you have an opinion on that at Duke?
I do. So we are embarked on analysis related to our ash basins, which will inform Diener's review of the 10 sites that were alluded to earlier, which did not include a legislative designation.
Let me understand this. You're doing the analysis, and that will be passed on to Diener, and they will digest that information. Isn't that like the fox guarding the hen house?
Well, our analysis will inform the Diener review. Diener will have ultimate jurisdiction over deciding what analysis is necessary and what validation and verification is necessary. But by December of next year, Diener will apply designations to each of those 10 remaining facilities as high risk, intermediate risk, or low risk. Those designations will then be reviewed and approved or rejected by the Coal Ash Management Commission. So in that interpretation, I believe the Coal Ash Management Commission has ultimate authority over the designations of those sites. And the designations of the sites is very important because that dictates certain options associated with the closure plans. We haven't really talked about the closure options yet.
Okay. Is that your understanding of how it all works, Michael?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, the words in the legislation are very clear. They say review and approve.
Okay. Closure options. Well, before we get to closure options, you talked about the determining whether these are – what were the words that you used in terms of risk?
So high risk, intermediate risk, or low risk?
Because, Rick, I know that the Catawba Riverkeeper Association has filed suit over the three coal ash ponds situated around Charlotte's drinking water reservoirs. Do you feel that these are high risk, that we're in imminent danger of something happening here along the lines of a Dan River, or you just want them out of there closed because they're near our drinking water supply?
Well, there are multiple factors here. So there are four active ash ponds and a number of inactive ash ponds and even more old disposal facilities that are unlined at all of these coal-fired power plants. They're all on drinking water reservoirs on the Catawba River. There are multiple threats. So one threat is when this stuff leaks out and gets into through these million gallons a day of seeps at River Bend, it builds up in the sediment. When the oxygen levels in the lake change, we see periodic spikes of things like arsenic, which are carcinogens, in the lake. So it is having an impact on the reservoir. And what makes this difference, when Sean was talking earlier about, oh, gee, we were doing what everybody else in the country did, big difference is here. We were putting these things on drinking water reservoirs. In most other places in the country, people were not putting unlined ash ponds on drinking water reservoirs. That's just people in the rest of the country look at that and say, that's nuts. So that's a concern. Yes, I do have concerns about unlined dams and how they were constructed, and there is a risk of a catastrophic failure. There is also a concern about the groundwater contamination. The fact that some of these things are naturally occurring, and by the way, they're not all naturally occurring, but the fact that some are naturally occurring doesn't really matter if they're at such high levels that they pose a threat to health. And that's why the groundwater standards were set. They're health-based standards. Even for something like iron or manganese, there is a level that is so high that it becomes a health risk. That's why we have the standards. They are exceeding those standards. So they do pose a health risk.
So if you were to win your suit, what would the outcome be?
The outcome would be more than just closure. So we've talked today, Duke always talks in terms of closing the ash ponds. We want to see a cleanup. Closing them is not enough. Just shutting them down and saying, okay, we're all done. We want to see it cleaned up, the groundwater cleaned up, the sediment that's been contaminated out in the drinking water reservoir cleaned up.
When Duke says, when you talk about closing these ash ponds, what are you thinking about? What do you mean?
Absolutely. And real quickly here, just for your listeners, I think one question on my mind would be, is our drinking water safe in Charlotte? The answer is yes. Are our reservoirs safe for human activity? Can we swim? Can we fish? Can we recreate? The answer is yes.
And can you say that beyond a shadow of a doubt that we will not have a problem with leakage or a spill of the dams or a vast amount of material like what happened on the Dan River happening at Mountain Island Lake, which is our reservoir for water in Charlotte? You can say that beyond a shadow of a doubt.
So, Mike, you know, what I can say beyond a shadow of a doubt is today, as we sit here today, that drinking water is safe, that the reservoirs are safe for humans and for aquatic life.
Let me just comment. There are fish advisories for PCBs and mercury, both things associated with the generation of electricity in Mountain Island Lake. How did that stuff get there?
PCBs are not considered associated with our coal-fired
power plant. Well, what's interesting is these ash ponds are not just permitted to receive coal ash waste. Every type of waste virtually at the power plant went into the coal ash ponds. We know we've got high PCB levels in the lake. Where is it coming from? They're associated with electrical equipment. I know back in my engineering days when I worked in a power plant and I had something that had to be disposed of, where did they tell me to put it? They said, put it in the ash pond. I think everything went there. Even the permit today allows any type of lab waste, any type of degreasing waste, to go into the ash pond.
Is that true at Duke Energy?
There are a number of permitted applications in our basins, and those are all subject to the
Permitted by the EPA, permitted by DENR?
Well, the limits established by EPA and DENR.
Okay. So getting back to closure, when you say closing these plants, what are you talking about?
Well, it will, of course, be driven in large part by the designations made, proposed by DENR and ultimately endorsed by the Coal Ash Management Commission. It could come in a number of ways. And closure is never, Rick, you know, closure is never as simple as us saying they're closed. It could be beneficial reuse, which could be in the form of a lined structural fill, similar to what's being done at the Asheville Airport already. It could be in the form of beneficial reuse associated with concrete, for example. Another option would be a full-scale excavation, remove the ash away from the water, and put it into a lined landfill scenario. And then a third option would be to have a cap and control there on site, where we consolidate the ash, reduce the footprint, and have a synthetic cap that's put over top of it.
Isn't there a fourth option that you suggested at Duke for filling up old mines with this ash, essentially putting the waste
mine
product
reclamation
back where it went, where it came from originally, correct?
So the announcement last week would include some clay mine reclamation projects, which would be to remove ash from these sites in North Carolina and put them into a lined landfill, a lined structural fill scenario. Yes.
So this is what they were calling, as Sean mentioned, they're doing this at the Asheville Airport. There was some talk about doing it at Charlotte Douglas Airport. It's not going to happen under where the planes are. But the term that I've been heard being used for it is a coal ash burrito. All right. And what that is basically you take the coal ash, you wrap it in clay and plastic, and you know, there's a liner in it to protect it. And it's gotten pretty positive reviews from, I think, you know, Rick, for instance. I think when I talked to him about the plan, he was in on that. And the idea is that when we talk about structural fill, that's what they're talking about here, is you use it instead of dirt to when you want to level land. So you have mines that are dug out, they're holes in the ground, and you would put these coal ash burritos into where the holes were so that the land can be reused for other purposes.
So let me ask a really stupid question, Rick, because I understand Ben saying that you guys are kind of on board with this. You think this is a good idea. And I know that other environmental organizations have said that this is a good idea, right? Am I right?
Correct. We believe that taking the ash to a lined disposal facility with leachate collection is a good
idea. Well, here's my stupid question. Aren't you just spreading the problem around? Right now, we know where the problem is. We know they're contained in these 32 enormous coal ash ponds. you're taking this stuff out, you're wrapping it in clay and plastic, you're sticking it under runways, you're sticking it in flower beds, you're sticking it in the medians of the road. Isn't that just spreading it everywhere so that if it does break or leach into the groundwater, it really leaches into the ground?
Well, first of all, it is already being spread everywhere. It is being used as fill under roadways, under construction projects, under hundreds of sites, even just in Mecklenburg County.
Is that a good or a bad thing?
That's a bad thing. If it's not lined and people are unaware that this stuff is there, I know of one case where somebody has put a drinking water well right through the coal ash that was used at a site. And you can go to that restaurant, you can get coffee, you can get water made from water that was steeped in coal ash. And that's crazy.
Okay, let's share some comments that have come in as we've been talking. Forrest on Facebook, we, the consumers, already paid for the proper disposal of the coal ash when the energy was produced. If Duke Energy failed to properly account for costs at that time of production and gave that money away in the form of shareholder profits and executive pay and bonuses, well then, that's on them. They get to pay for all of it, and none of it gets to be added to our future bills. Any comment on that, Sean?
Sure, I would. So, you know, if we step back in time once again, coal ash is a byproduct associated with the generation of electricity from coal-fired power plants.
Okay.
And the industry norm over many years was to store coal ash in ponds. So, you know, the cost recovery question, as I had said before, will be something that's addressed directly by the Utilities Commission. Have our decisions been prudent? Both in terms of how we've managed our coal ash operations and then how we've chosen to pursue storage and closure options.
Let me just comment briefly. The industry norm was not to put coal ash in unlined ponds next to drinking water reservoirs that were leaking into the drinking water reservoir.
How many coal ash ponds are there, or how many coal ash storage sites are there in the country?
Over 670.
All right. Now, I know that in South Carolina, SCE&G and Santee Cooper have been cleaning up. They've been getting rid of their coal ash disposal sites. Were they in lined wet ponds, or was it dry storage at the time? And where were those?
At the plant, the watery plant, which is the continuation of the Catawba River. We did file a lawsuit on that one. Mm-hmm. They did have a leaking, unlined pond, but it wasn't on a drinking water reservoir, and that's a big difference. Okay. When you have a problem at a place that isn't on a drinking water reservoir, it's a different issue.
All right. Roy on Facebook, hearing the attempt to rationalize directly passing the cost of Duke's mistakes to the shareholders via populist appeal with the list of particularly popular shareholders is just sad. If I were sloppy in my business and caused some kind of environmental impact, I'd have to pay for my negligence. If I had stock, my stockholders would bear those costs. Being that my business operates in a real market, I could not increase my prices much before customers would go elsewhere. Of course, Duke doesn't have that issue. I guess that list of populist shareholders or popular shareholders came from the list that you put in your statement, Michael Jacobs. I don't know who should respond to that, if anybody.
Well, the reason I put it in my statement is because I want people to understand who the shareholders of Duke are. It's very easy to say the Duke shareholders should bear all of the cost. But it's important to understand if that is your position, and I'm not saying whether that's a valid or an invalid position. What I'm saying is you need to be an informed person to make that position. And you need to understand that there are 900,000 people that are a beneficial shareholder of Duke through the state pension fund. I'm on the board of the state pension fund in North Carolina. I'm well aware of that fact. You also need to understand.
But you're also the founder and CEO of Jacobs Capital, which provides merger and acquisition and business valuation services to middle market companies. You've been an investment banker. We've bailed out the investment banker business in 2008, and everybody got off scot-free except the people who invested. I mean, isn't this? Aren't you giving yourself an easy out here? Aren't you giving? I mean, when you invest, you are risking your capital.
I am not making any statement whatsoever, and I want to be perfectly clear. And anybody who reads my statement can read it very clearly. I'm not making any statement whatsoever about who should pay for the cleanup. What I'm saying is to those people that think that all of the shareholders of Duke are wealthy people who use their dividends to pay their country club dues, they need to understand that the shareholders also include the state pension fund, which has 900,000 members in it, and universities, endowment funds, and a lot of other people. So my point was that whether you put it on the ratepayers or you put it on the shareholders, people in North Carolina are going to be impacted by it, and so we need to pay attention to it. That's all my point was.
Okay. All right. I believe that the Environmental Protection Agency, I think I'm right about this, has never classified coal ash as a toxic substance, although they are considering whether to consider it toxic or merely solid waste. And I think that decision is impending at the moment. Let me ask the three of you, should it be considered toxic waste or solid waste, which means benign? Rick.
I think if you look at the risks posed by coal ash, in many respects, it's a hazardous waste. I understand why there is pressure to regulate it as something else. It probably makes sense in a perfect world that you could have some kind of sliding scale, but it certainly makes sense to say coal ash is a whole lot more hazardous than household garbage. And right now, household garbage has a higher level of regulation than coal ash.
So you think it should be classified as toxic waste?
Yes.
What is Duke Energy's position, Sean?
We support federal regulation. We believe the non-hazardous designation is appropriate.
Okay.
The hazardous designation has implications in terms of beneficial reuse, in terms of storage capacity, and in terms of cost.
Well, if they decide that it's hazardous waste, does everything we've been talking about this morning go back to the drawing board?
Not necessarily to the drawing board, but it would be a significant change in approach.
Okay. This is a remarkable topic that could go on for several hours, but we are completely out of time. And I want to thank Rick Gaskins, Executive Director of the Catawba River Keeper Foundation, Sean Heath from Duke Energy, and Michael Jacobs, the Chairman of the North Carolina Coal Ash Management Commission, for joining me, and Ben Bradford from WFAE News.